It's Frank Buckley. Today, my guest is Maria Hinojosa, a broadcast journalist who anchors and executive produces Latino USA on NPR. Her work on TV has won her multiple Emmys, and she's an author. Her new book, Once I Was You, a memoir of love and hate in a torn America. I first met Maria 20 years ago. We worked together at CNN, and I've always respected her reporting. She gets to the heart of stories, makes us see the people who are directly affected by policy debates over big issues like immigration. She helps us to better understand things like the painful separation of children from their parents at the border, makes us feel the plight of DACA dreamers whose futures are uncertain. Maria was born in Mexico and raised in Chicago, so when she says, "Once I was you," she means it quite literally. Here's my conversation with Maria Hinojosa. Maria, it is great to see you. Congratulations on this wonderful new book.
Thank you, Frank, and congratulations for everything that you're doing in your career. We miss you here in New York, but congratulations for everything you do for our profession in Los Angeles, and it's my thrill to be here with you.
Well, I feel the same way about you, and I've known you professionally. I didn't know your amazing backstory until I read this book, and how your family moved from Mexico to Chicago when you were a little girl, and how you even were stopped at the border and almost separated from your family as a child. Tell me that incredible story.
So it turns out, Frank, I came with a lot of privilege. So that's the first thing. I had a lot of privilege. I had a green card. My mother was flying in from Mexico City. Then we changed planes in Dallas, and then we were going to go off to Chicago. My father was a medical doctor dedicated to research. He helped to create the cochlear implant. May he rest in peace. And so we had privilege. But when we got to the Dallas airport, the immigration agent was studying our bodies. I remember my mother telling this story. Something had happened, you know, that he was looking at our bodies. And it wasn't until the crisis that erupted with the babies and their crying voices that we heard all across the country, these children who had been separated, taken from their parents, that my mother realized the trauma of what had happened to her. And she called me and she said, you know, what happened in the airport there, it wasn't just a mistake with like a confusion with the immigration agent, which is kind of the way it had been thought of. She said, no, they tried to take you. Mm. By this time, Frank, my mother is crying in tears, you know, and I'm just like, ¿qué pasa, ma? And then she said to me, those babies who have been taken from their mothers, that could have been you, mijita, that could have been you. And then, Frank, that's when I was like, wow. I mean, it's just like the realization of like the impact of trauma, how it stays with you, because then I understood why my life's work as a journalist has been immigration. I've covered multiple stories. We did all kinds of things together at CNN. But in my life's work, it really is immigration. And now I know why. I was almost one of those kids taken from their parent.
Yeah, and you've talked about the fact that in this book, the way you approach stories, you know, many of us cover something like immigration at 30,000 feet. We talk about the policies and we talk about, you know, why isn't there a comprehensive immigration reform and that sort of thing. You really introduce us to the human beings who are directly affected by this. And tell me, when you approach a story, you know, something as large as immigration, is the first thing that you do to try to find someone to humanize that? And how do you do that?
You know, Frank, as a journalist, you know that that's like our sweet spot, is actually being out on the street. That's why this is so hard right now, being, you know, pandemic. You know, I'm speaking to you from my home studio right now. And in New York, we still basically are observing the pandemic pretty intensely. But, you know, there's a young man who I met on the streets. He was sleeping on the streets in Matamoros, in Mexico, trying to cross over to McAllen. He was one of many who I interviewed, but I give people my phone number because they are my sources. These people become my sources. And to me, they are not just a passing story. That's why I give them my number. I'm like, stay in touch, whatever. Many of them don't because they're in a moment of trauma, but some of them do. And then I end up reporting about them. And, you know, I'm in touch with them right now. One of them is a refugee from Honduras who's calling me. He's now in Mexico. In part, he was able to get through Mexico because of our reporting. Another one just got in touch yesterday, Honduran immigrant here, whose child I write about. His photograph is in my book, Bobby, actually, who was almost taken from his mother. So to me, at this point in my career, Frank, I've won all of the awards, right? I've mm-hmm. won all of the awards. So I don't have to prove anymore what kind of a journalist I am in this country.
Yeah.
And the kind of journalist I am right now is that my heart is suffering. We don't have, I've been asked, do we have an immigration problem or how will the problem? We don't have an immigration issue, Frank. We have an international human rights crisis right now that is being carried on the backs of men, women, and children whose only crime was that we were not born here. I mean, ultimately, that is the litmus test. Anyone who was not born here, and even some American citizens, can end up in these detention facilities, which are concentration camps that are not death camps, but they are absolutely inhuman places. So it's gone beyond just the issue of immigration. And that's part of what Once I Was You is trying to do. It's saying, Once I Was You, we have to see ourselves in each other.
Yeah. And you talk about those concentration camps, as you call them, and people think, wait a minute, this is a Trump issue. And if you look at the body of your work, you go back, and I'm thinking about the Frontline documentary you did, where you went into camps and you saw the inhumanity with which people were living and the profit that some were making off of the backs of people who were being given food that was not edible so that they could save some money. Talk about the fact that this is not just one administration or one a bad guy. This is our country and the way we treat our fellow human beings.
One of the most kind of special moments for me in writing this, Frank, was when I realized that I have a connection to the first group of people that were excluded by law from the United States. And they were Chinese women, Asian women, were excluded by law. Then came the Chinese Exclusion Act. So in the 1880s. So now I realize that my mother was like the Asian Chinese women who were trying to come to be reunited with their working husbands. That's how far back it goes. I'm a stone's throw, if I knew how to throw and had a really good arm, from the Statue of Liberty, right? Yeah. So the narrative is that we are an open country, but the policies on the Democrats and them, the Republicans, that's not what it is. So really, the last president who was good for immigration that increased the numbers to about 220,000 for refugees, for example, that was George H.W. Bush. Mm. Bill Clinton was the one who started the wall and who signed into law very restrictive immigration laws that ended up being used right now as a way to detain and hold all of these people. So a pox on both of their houses. And I know that the Democrats and the Republicans really hate it when I say that. But as journalists, we have to call it for what it is. It brought me no joy when I was writing the history and uncovering it and just being like, wow, like Bill Clinton was running on an anti-immigrant platform. How is that? Mm. So we now, all of us, have the wool has been taken off for many Americans who weren't thinking about immigration. You are now thinking about this. And it's not a far-off issue, especially for people in L.A. These are your neighbors. These are your friends. These are your kids' friends. We're talking about our country. And the only way that the issue of immigration is going to change, really, is if all of us get involved in it. That's the only way.
Let me ask you, when you say something like that, it reminds me of a passage in your book where you talk about someone at NPR saying to you, you have a Latino agenda. And what do you say to that? People say, look, you're a journalist. You're supposed to be a dispassionate journalist telling me a story, telling me both sides, whatever that means today. What do you say to them?
Objectivity is not owned by any one person. And I write about working for Walter Cronkite and writing for Walter Cronkite. So this whole notion of objectivity is something that we are all really dissecting right now. Look, it's very important. One of the things that I do as a journalist in my role is to not come in with a judgment. That's why I speak to a lot of people who are Trump supporters, and I sit and I listen to them. That's my role as a journalist, is to listen non-judgmentally. At the same time, Frank, are we at a point in the United States of America where legitimately you are going to have a news editor tell you, well, you know, there are the pros and cons of putting children in cages after we've ripped them from the arms of their parents?
Right.
So if we have gotten to that point, then there is something seriously wrong with our profession. And one of the things that I say is that, and we know this because you and I are part of this conversation, journalism does better when it is more diverse. Mm-hmm. And that's not a political issue. That is being the best journalists that we can be in this country.
Yes.
It leads to better journalism. And that way you don't refer to human beings as illegal people. That
right.
is not the term that we use. So we need to have more journalists of color and of conscience as part of the conversation.
I agree
that's
with you.
That's what
there.
I say.
One of the chapters of Maria's new book is What I Cannot Unsee. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, we are going to ask Maria, what can you not unsee?
The Angie's List you know and trust is now Angie, and we're so much more than just a list. We still connect you with top local pros and show you ratings and reviews, but now we also let you compare upfront prices on hundreds of projects and book a service instantly. We can even handle the rest of your project from start to finish. So remember, Angie's List is now Angie, and we're here to get your job done right. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I, or download the app today.
We're back with Maria Hinojosa, the executive producer and anchor of Latino USA and the author of Once I Was You, a memoir of love and hate in a torn America. Maria, as we speak, there are some 545 children who remain separated from their parents, who had been separated at the border. And we are now being told that those children, their parents, cannot be located, that the prospect of them getting back together, the parent and child, that they don't know what they're going to do. Can you tell me, first of all, your reaction to how we have gotten to that place in our country?
It's despicable. I'm sorry, Frank. And this, again, you know, there's not a pro and con of this story. There's just not two sides to this story. And so the notion that a country that has the capacity to send men and women to the moon, potentially to Mars, right, that we cannot find parents, that is the level of dehumanization, which is like, oh, well, can't find them. That's what we're talking about. This is much more than just children. We're talking about dehumanization. And all of us have to recognize that, you know, we have been alive while this has been happening. By the way, I'm sorry to say I do not have the exact proof here in front of me, but I am sure it is many more than 545 children. Mm. You know, just in my own situation, there is a woman whose child was almost taken from her. And the reason why they didn't take the child was because she screamed and would not let go of the child because the child is deaf. I'm sorry, is mute and blind. Mm. So there was no way for that child to ever be able to recognize his mother again, blind. And they tried to take this child. So sadly now, you know, we in this country have to recognize that we will hear the horror stories later. You know, of children who were put up for adoption, who had parents who loved them.
Yeah.
And this very strange story where suddenly American parents become the saviors to children as if they were from unloving families from Central America. No, they came fleeing violence. They are refugees. And suddenly now they lose their children taken by a government for no reason. So this is where, you know, in Once I Was You, it's like, let's put it into context and let's move with our humanity. What's radical, I found it very interesting, Biden saying something like, you know, I'm not going to be too radical. And it's just like, on the issue of immigration, what's radical is what has been allowed to happen. That women have their uteruses taken from them and that mothers have their children taken from them. That is the United States of America. And when I say it only changes, and is this an activism? No, democracy is a verb. So when I say that, Frank, it's, do I think that doctors should not be taking women's uteruses? Period.
Yeah.
Yes.
I think we can all agree on that. Here's what some people are going to say. They will say, look, these migrants who decided to bring their children to the border, and they knew there were dangers associated with that, and they knew the policy when they arrived at the border. It's their fault. To them, you say what?
They didn't know the policy. And when people say, no, that's not true, well, go down and do what I did. Speak to the people. I saw a woman standing in line with her baby. And I said, Señora, this was in El Paso. I said, Señora, do you know what's happening? And I don't want to terrify them also, right? Mm. Because they're traumatized.
Yeah.
But I said, do you know what might happen? No, what are you talking about? They might take your child. No, they won't do that. So this notion that people know the policy, no. What people don't understand, because the image has been created by this administration that people coming in caravans are, you know, criminals and rapists and murderers, they are not. They are not migrants. They are refugees. Mm. And we are not talking about hundreds of thousands of people. We're talking about several thousand people. So these are not countries that are emptying out. They're not. But the people that I speak to, Frank, if I faced what they faced, if my children faced what they faced, to me, they're the heroes of the picture. They're the ones, you know, most of us, when we feel trauma, we get stuck. Mm-hmm. You know, after 9/11, I couldn't move. I was stuck. I couldn't leave New York. These are people who, in the midst of trauma, say, I've got to run. I've got to go. So they are the heroes and heroines of the picture.
One of the chapters in your book is titled, What I Cannot Unsee. Why did you write that as the title of your chapter?
Sandra Cisneros, my muse, told me that, you know, sometimes when she knew I was going to be writing this book, she said, you know, you don't always have to write about what you remember. Write about what you wish you could forget, or what you've already tried to forget, or what you wish you could unsee. I mean, whenever you ask that question, I immediately think of interviewing the people who worked in the detention camps on the border in Texas, and that, you know, somebody came to the nurse and showed them what they had been fed that day. And they opened up the napkin, and in the napkin was live maggots. And they were served spoiled oatmeal, because that's how they save money, the private prisons that run these places. You know, hearing the stories of people being raped. I was reporting about this in 2011. So the situation has not gotten better. It's gotten worse. One thing, one image, that story of people standing in line when they were in a concentration camp, captured in films in Hollywood, you know, trying to get to a shower, naked, skinny. One woman said, "That I felt like I was in Schindler's List."
Mm.
That image, Frank, is one that will never leave my mind. A Mexican woman said, did you ever hear of a movie called Schindler's List? And I'm like, yes. We kind of felt like that's what it looked like for us. This is not something that is in the past, Frank. This is happening today in California, in every state almost across the country. There are detention camps where this is happening. And it happens because there's no oversight. There's impunity.
The children who are separated from their parents at the border, can you tell me what their daily life is like?
You know, here's what I know. First of all, it is very, very hard for journalists to get into these places. So that's a primary thing. And that should not exist. Like, we should have access to be able to go to these places and be witness.
Yeah.
When I went to the converted Walmart in Texas, by the border where they were housing children, you did not see a child outside. It was the middle of the day. You would think that, you know, children, if you have 1,500 children in a converted Walmart, that some of those children would be out and about.
Yeah.
No children anywhere. That means that when you ask, what are they doing? They're sitting inside these large caged areas with these, you know, aluminum blankets and often sitting on the floor. They are not given, you know, this notion of they're going to get school or they're going to get, it's all minimal. It's all minimal. And the reason why is because there's a profit motive here. Every child, every person, every human being who is held there signifies it's a profit for the private prison industry. So you have to look at why would they go over and above to give them a healthcare, schooling, books, television? That's all money that they're going to say, well, why? That's lost money. These children will, you know, who cares about them? It's very sick what's going on, the level that we've gotten to, Frank. But this is where we are. And it's going to take many years and real leadership to deconstruct this. Whether or not Joe Biden will do that, it's unclear. And certainly if Trump is in office, this will only intensify.
So many people direct their upset over our lack of immigration reform in this country at President Trump. And yet, President Obama was not exactly the model of humanity when it came to immigration and immigrants. I mean, he was called the deporter in chief. So it seems to me that there is plenty to go around when we start wanting to point the finger.
It's very unfortunate. You know, I think this is the thing that Barack Obama, it will be his nemesis. It will be his nightmare. It will be the thing that hovers over him until he decides to kind of own it. What's hard for me about President Obama's decision is that, you know, he was a constitutional scholar. Mm-hmm. He was a lawyer who taught that before becoming a politician. And so this notion that he would actively be denying people due process, because when you get down to it, Frank, here's what it looks like. If you have a green card or you are undocumented and you are picked up by immigration, you're not a criminal. So you're not getting the criminal, you're not getting the treatment that a potential criminal would get, which means you get Mirandized, you have to be held for 48 hours or released, you get access to a phone call and a lawyer, all the things that we learn on Law and Order. You don't get that if you are an immigrant. So immediately you are being denied a series of basic due process. And sadly, you know, Obama just went overboard. That's where it gets scary, because we're talking about tens of thousands of employees who are part of this system. You're talking about massive budgets now. So the mass deportation detention industrial complex is real.
Yeah.
How do you stop it? That is going to be a big challenge. I mean, what you do is you basically flip it. All of those resources that were being used to detain people are now resources that should be used to reunite people, to give mental health care, to give treatment to the people who have been traumatized by this country's policies.
I want to think that the vast majority of Americans are humane and feel sympathy for the refugees who are fleeing violence in their countries or economic depravity in their countries, who see America as a place that will keep them safe, that will provide them with opportunity. I don't know that that's true, but that's what I want to believe. And I also understand, though, people who say, look, we have to have a border. We have to have a policy. We can't just say anybody can come in at any time. There's only so much, whether it's space or jobs or whatever. What do you say to that argument that, look, we can't just say yes to everyone?
not everybody wants to come. So that's the first thing. Not everybody wants to come. I mean, we're at net zero immigration right now from Mexico. If you look at California, right, our Mexican immigrants, and by the way, the people who were there before California became California, right, when it was Mexico, are they some sort of a problem or a drain? So you're like, oh, well, there was too many. No. So, okay, so this notion, nobody, like certainly not me, and by the way, I don't make policy, but I understand countries need to protect their borders. Nobody is saying that. We've gone overboard now. Mm. Our borders look like the Berlin Wall, mm-hmm. if you haven't been there recently. That's what they look like. And that is this notion that we're somehow being, you know, attacked from the outside. We are not. So many people want to come here and establish a life, but a lot of people don't. That's why, you know, this notion that there are so many people coming in these caravans, it's not tens of thousands of people. These are the most desperate. And you know what? These are people who are hungry for life. You want them here. But there are some people who are like, you know what? I want to come. I want to work. I'd be happy to do, you know, a work visa temporary so that I can go back and forth. Like, that should absolutely be offered. Mm-hmm. But also, if you come and you decide to work and then you have kids and then it's like you thought you were going to go back but your kids want to stay, why shouldn't you be allowed to be a part of this country? And here's the last thing, Frank. This notion of able to do it the right way, mm-hmm. if there was a right way, if there was a line to stand in, people would do that. Now, right now, we're not talking about an inhumane line like what Donald Trump has done in saying to refugees, sleep on the sidewalk for a year if you have to. That's not what we're talking about. But if there was a process to say, look, I've got family, I'd like to come, I've got a job, I've got a this. People do not want to be coming into the country illegally. They do not. They do not, under any circumstance. So people need to understand they don't want to do that. Mm. At the same time, this country needs to own its role. I was, before the pandemic, I was in Mississippi, central Mississippi, where the poultry processing plant raid happened. Mm-hmm. Guatemalans from the highlands, indigenous Guatemalans from the highlands, did not just happen to get on one or two buses and get off in Mississippi because they were like, hey, you know, like this is an interest. No, they were recruited. They were recruited. And then they come and they're doing the jobs that nobody else wants to do with love, by the way, processing chickens with love. Mm-hmm. And then there's a raid and now you want to deport them? I mean, this is silly. It's silly. And people who are economists and business people with right minds should be able to figure this out. It has become politicized. And sadly, under the Trump administration, really hate-filled. And you are right to get back to the top of your question, Frank. The overwhelming majority of people in the United States actually don't want this division. They actually are really good with the pathway to citizenship, good with, you know, regularizing people. They are. That's what's so sad about where we are right now, because we've lost so many people, broken so many families, destroyed a lot of people's lives, left trauma in so many people's hearts and minds, and it was really not necessary.
Yeah. I want to take another quick break. And when we come back, I'd like to ask Maria about the political power of the Latino people in America. Will it be flexed in this election cycle? We'll talk about that in just a moment.
Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte clear liners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you could pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Mm-hmm. We're back with Maria Hinojosa. Maria, this year in this election cycle, Latinos are for the first time going to be the nation's largest racial or ethnic minority in the election cycle. Record 32 million projected to be eligible to vote. Now, in the past, people have said Latinos have not flexed their political muscle. Now, obviously, no group is a monolith, but there is a great deal of political power there. Do you feel like the Latino people have flexed their muscle as much as they can?
Oh, no. As much as they can? Absolutely not. We are the second largest voting bloc in the United States of America. The second largest, period. I would ask the viewers, do they feel like Latinos, that they feel like Latinos and Latinas are the second largest voting bloc? They're probably going to be like, no, not really. So there is still a lot of invisibility in the media, and there's still a lot of invisibility in terms of the campaigns. So politics is a transaction. You know that, Frank. And so if Latinos and Latinas are not coming out to vote, it's because those votes were not looked for. Right. I became an American citizen. I was born in Mexico. So for me, voting is like, oh, my God, you know, like that's my thing because I became an American citizen in order to vote. But for other people, you know, you've got to go after that vote. What did we see that I wasn't necessarily expecting was that Bernie Sanders went after that vote, got the vote. So if Biden does not do hugely well with Latinos and Latinas, it's because it was his to lose. What we do know is that the Trump campaign has been doing kind of consistent outreach, kind of targeted specific outreach, Latino and Latina evangelicals in Central Florida for the win of Florida. But what we also know is that younger Latinos and Latinas, a Latino turns 18 every 60 to 90 seconds in the United States, huge population. That's the population to watch, Frank. Mm. What will young Latinos and Latinas do? And we don't have a lot of polling, so we're going to have to wait and see. And I'm just hoping, not because I'm, you know, one way or another, I just am a democracy junkie. I want people to be involved with democracy because it's a verb, not a noun.
Part of your title is a memoir of love and hate in a torn America. Are you optimistic that we're going to bring this country back together?
I am optimistic that we can do it, but here's the thing. It's all of us. It's not just you. It's not just me. And sometimes that means getting out of your comfort zone. And sometimes it means putting a little bit of honey on your tongue to talk with somebody that you disagree with. But this is what a democracy looks like. So, yes. And if California is any kind of harbinger, then yes, absolutely. Yeah. This country can deal with change, demographic change, growth. There is enough in this country for all of us. So, yes, I remain hopeful.
Maria, it's great to see you, and congratulations once again. The book is available right now, Once I Was You. It's good to see you.
Thank you, Frank. Thank you, Frank.
Hope you enjoyed the conversation with Maria. If you have any feedback, I hope you'll tag me on social media. It's Frank Buckley TV on Twitter and on Instagram, and there's a Frank Buckley Facebook page as well. We drop a new podcast every Wednesday, and we air our TV show on KTLA every weekend. And you can find all of our TV programs on YouTube as well. Thanks for listening, and until next time, I'll see you on TV.